This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. This crazy news week does affect a lot of different things. And so to prepare you for the week to come, we're going to start with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance to talk about the news. Long, as in betting on something. Short, as in betting against it. And this week, we have The Atlantic's Jillian White and The LA Times' Natalie Kitcheroff. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Lizzie.
Thanks for having us.
So, all right, I want to mix this up a little bit. I'm going to start with a short, the thing we are betting against, or one of you is betting against. Jillian, why don't you throw out your short first and explain it to us?
Yeah, sure. So I am short full employment. I'm not sure that we will ever get to full employment, but I am short both on the idea that we have a great definition of full employment and that we have reached it. So as of the last jobs report, a lot of people were saying that we were either at full employment or near full employment. And that's in part because the jobless rate, the unemployed rate, has been so low for so long.
Yeah, 4.4%. That's low.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. Except for the fact that a lot of economists that I've talked to agree that the unemployment rate should not be the sole factor in determining whether or not we are technically at full employment. Full employment, in theory, is this kind of robust figure of everyone who wants to have a job, you know, can work and is making a good living. And the thing that people are concerned about are a couple of things. So one, it's that labor force participation, while it's not still falling, hasn't really risen all that much. So there are a bunch of people who would normally be working who are not in the labor force, and that gives a lot of people pause. And two, wage growth is not as fast as people want it to be. There's been a little growth, but the acceleration has been pretty paltry. So the idea that the job market is completely healed and that there's no more growth that could happen there in terms of wages, in terms of participation, I don't think we're there yet. And a lot of people seem to kind of be on the same page. So calling it full employment right now really only looks at that unemployment rate. And that just doesn't seem to be robust enough.
Well, this is a thing I have questions about, because you and I and Natalie, we think about this concept. Economists think about this concept. But if you ask just about any regular person on the street, they'd probably laugh in our faces if we told them that the economy was at full employment right now.
Yeah. There's such a disconnect right now between what the data might say in terms of the unemployment rate and what people are actually feeling. So I think there's this gap that everyone wants to kind of fill where the data might show something different and it would reflect more closely what people are actually feeling in their everyday lives.
So I want to turn this slightly because, Natalie, your short fits really well into this conversation. Tell me what you're short.
Yes. I am short women's participation in the workforce. So a lot of the focus has been on missing men. Why are men not looking for work anymore? And this has been a really long-term decline for men in their participation rate. Women are a different story because for a half a century, women were increasing their participation in the labor force steadily. And then around 2000, really in 99, that peaked and has since declined. We're now at 74% for prime age women. Why are women staying at home? What has changed sort of from the 90s to today? You know, there's a lot of very kind of women-specific reasons why women may be staying home. One of them is the fact that the cost of childcare has risen while wages have not grown as quickly as they were when women were kind of entering the workforce in droves.
Yeah, it's hard to make that math work. I mean, childcare costs a lot of money.
Right. There are other problems with our workforce that are keeping women out of it. Janet Yellen, the chairwoman of the Fed, recently gave a speech at Brown where she essentially said, if we can't fix this problem, we're going to have a problem because our population is aging. You know, the president wants to limit immigration. In order to become more productive as an economy, we need to have people doing work, producing more things. And women are half the population.
And that conversation about women in the workforce is one that Natalie Kitcheroff, who's an economy reporter for the LA Times, will publish soon. We're also talking with Jillian White, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Jillian, I want to turn it back to you and go with what you are long. What are you betting on?
So I am long the impact of the CBO score, which will be released next week. CBO meaning Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan office that is responsible for taking a look at legislation and figuring out basically what the cost-benefit analysis of it is.
And we're talking about the healthcare bill passed by the GOP House here, yes?
Yes, exactly. So the House went ahead and pushed forward with their health care bill ahead of the CBO scoring, which a lot of people were critical of. Because, as I said, the CBO score kind of comes out and says, all right, this is how much money will be saved. This is how much it will cost. And in the past, the CBO has come out with some figures that have been kind of devastating for the GOP's plans for repeal and replace. So last time they went ahead and did their score, it was the famed CBO number of 24 million, and that was 24 million more people who would be uninsured by 2026 based on the Republican repeal and replace bill. And that was kind of the thing that people really blamed or credited, depending on what side you're on, with kind of derailing the whole plan. And I just think that the CBO score still has a lot of weight to it. I think it will hold some impact, and a lot of people are waiting to see what it looks like. And honestly, a lot of people that I've talked to here in Washington don't think that much will have changed from the last report.
I don't know. I might have to disagree with you. Not being long the CBO, but I'm sort of short anything that is trying to move on Capitol Hill amid this incredibly frenetic news environment. You know, we have seen stocks drop this week. I think that is the stock market saying, maybe we're probably not going to get tax reform. There is, in Washington, often a limited amount of political bandwidth. I think healthcare may have an easier time than tax reform, but I don't know, man. There's a lot going on Capitol Hill, and legislating is hard.
That is a thing we all learned recently, right?
Natalie, why don't you tell us what you're long?
So I am long on trade and services. When Donald Trump talks about the deficit, he really harps on manufactured goods, steel, sort of durable products.
Our trade deficit with other countries?
Yeah, that's right. The reality is that where we hold the biggest advantage is in services. And I'm talking about kind of high-level services, financial services, anything involved with the internet, consulting, architecture, you know, financial payment systems. These are the kinds of innovations that the U.S. is out in front of. And right now, only 5% of U.S. businesses that produce exportable services are exporting them.
Huh.
That is a huge opportunity. 25% of manufacturers are exporting. So that divide there gives you a sense of just how much room we have to grow. And we're not focusing on it right now, but if we were to kind of step up our pressure on our trading partners to remove barriers for trade in services, for example, opening up channels for data to flow between countries more easily, that would really lift a lot of our homegrown technological financial services.
Helping us get a jump on the economic news for the week ahead, that was Natalie Kitcheroff from the LA Times and Jillian White from the Atlantic. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.